Ready?
Yep.
Okay. This is 27th of October. My name is Varpu Latvanen and I'm here with Isaac Junubi in Eagle Village. And I am going to interview Isaac for Yukon Charlie Ethnographic Overview Project about his experience and life in Eagle and around. So, Isaac, I'd like to first hear something about your background. Where you were born and where did you grow up? And
I was born in Eagle Village, Alaska, and part of my time growing up was down in the Yukon Charlie River, Coal Creek, and we spent a number of year rounds over there. My dad would work for the dredge in the summertime, and then in the wintertime they would take care of the camp and cut firewood for the camp and also for the dredge for the following year. So we stayed down there, I believe about 6, 7, possibly 8 years down in there during the latter part of 1940 and early 1950s. And there were three families there, the Pauls, the Junibis, and the Davids. And we were all within a little place they call Snare Creek. And that's where my bringing up was. And then after 1952, when they opened a school up here in Eagle Village, we all moved back up here to start school. And I went to school right here and finished my 8th grade. From there I went to Mount Edgecombe High School down in Sitka, Alaska, and finished there 4 years. And it wasn't in later years that in 1988 that I did work and got a I graduated from university with a BA in lands and rural development. And it was 23 years later that I came back into college. But the point of it is that I did some military time back in the early 60s, and I was out for 2 years with finishing my obligation with the military, Army. And in latter years, I worked at Tim Machis as a realty officer for about 18 years. And then I keep coming back here and I work with the Village Council. Two or three different jobs in their programs here, and I am now an employment EPA coordinator here in the Eagle Village Council.
So, do you have many sisters or brothers?
I got two sisters and one brother living, but at one time I think there was 12 of us together, all together, but there's only two, me and my other brother, and two sisters. There's four of us left. And I also have a lot of nieces and nephews here. Not here, but they're in Fairbanks and elsewhere. My mom and dad died. My mom died in 1995, and my dad died in 1988, and my dad died in 1995.
And so what was your mother's name? I know your dad was Willie Junubi, right?
My mother's name was Louise Silas, and she was born and raised in Moose High. But at that time, the Canadians can come down here, and we moved back and forth up there, and there was no problem with that. In fact, if I look at some of the old people here at that time, let's say back in the 30s and 1940s, possibly a lot of them had residence up there, and the other ones from over there had residence here. So it was come and go anytime as they pleased. My mom was born over there. She's originally from what they call Moose Hide.
So at that time people could still go back and forth? But when did it change?
I believe back in the 50s, 1950s, it changed. At that time, you know, you still had a boundary, and you still had a, like customs, but natives at that time can come and go in any way they want to. But now you have to go through customs like everybody else. But at one time, they just come and go. People used to come from Dawson just to trap over in this side, and then there was even some people that do the same thing over there, trap in their country and come back.
Do you know how your mother ended up coming to Eagle? And
she married my dad, who worked on the riverboats, steamboat, and that's why she became a U.S. citizen. If you married somebody, a male over here, and you automatically become a U.S. citizen. Yeah, that's the way she came over, and I think it was 1935.
Did you know your grandparents?
I never seen them, I never know them, but my grandparents on my mom's side was Andrew and Ellen Silas, and my dad was Big Jim and Sarah Junabee. And my dad's dad was a U.S. Marshal and an Episcopal minister, lay reader. It was during the turn of the century when there used to be gold rush into Eagle from Canada, like the Klondike gold rush. A lot of them came down through all these tributaries and mine.
That must have been a really interesting time for...
Well, you know, I wasn't born then, but I know it was an interesting time, because one of the things everybody was... you see, the gold rush up in Dawson and Klondike started everything. And then they had the military down here come in. And the military was one of the things that was supposed to keep law and order between the two countries. And that's why they came here. Plus, they said the military also did the telegraph, the first telegraph ever to be in Alaska. I think they call it the Womcats. That's what the telegraph wires were called. And people-wise, I think that one time there was 2,000 people downtown. I don't know how many bars and how many hotels. It was good back in the day. Now we're pretty small.
Yeah. Eagle was busier at the time.
Well, gold rush, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you know about origins of your family or your people? Do you know?
All I know is that I don't know much about my family, but I know that the Han Indians were nomadic, and they traveled from one place to another all during the year. They would probably start in Eagle and go across country to a place called Ketchumstuck by Chicken. They go over in there and they do their thing there for the winter, and that's where they go, and they stay there all winter. And in the summertime they start going back into the lakes and the rivers. And that's over by Canacross, down there by Took, there's a place they call Mansfield Lake. That's where they go to. And then from there, they go during the summer over into Kipland. That's another native village over in there, about 20 miles of east of Took. And from there, they go into the White River up in Canada. Into the White River, and then into the Yukon they float, and then to go to Dawson, 60 miles they float to Dawson, and then they come back down to Eagle, and they do a lot of fishing, hunting on the rivers and lakes. And then in the fall time the cycle starts over again, same thing, they make a circle back and forth. And during this process they get a lot of caribou and moose. But it's springtime, you're mostly waterfowl and fish. like in the summer, early summer, get fish, grayling, king salmon, dog salmon, chum salmon, and chinooks.
So didn't they go down river?
I think there was another clan down below at Charlie River. They call it Charlie Village. But I think this was one of the main place right in here. But each different place that they stay for quite a number of, quite a while. So, and then they do a lot of potlatches and they do a lot of other things that they share and share, you know. But we have relatives as far down at that time as Charlie River, which is about 80 miles down below. So there was another clan there. So they probably joined up with this. They're actually the same people, but it's just a different, you know, there's a David clan and then this clan here, and I think there was another little one down below. Three different clans I think they had in there. Johnny's Village, that was just right down here.
Didn't the Charlie Village flood one year?
Huh?
I remember reading from somewhere that the Charlie Village flooded and
from what the people from what I understand is that when Charlie flooded, it kind of dispersed those people that lived there. Some went to Circle, some came back up here, and right today there are some homes in Circle, and up north of there's a few. They're not a village, but there's some individuals that are Han. Circle has Han. We call ourselves the Han Kuchin, people of the river, people who live on the river. And then down Circle, they call themselves the Han Danjit Honlit. Danjit Honlit. I don't know. That's Danjit Honlit. That's the name of their Han Indians there. But there, you see, Circle, they got a lot of Gwich'ins there from Fort Yukon area. So, but I know that there's a few Hans in the in Circle itself. Yeah. And I think that at one time when they flooded down there, it dispersed those people. Some of them came back to Eagle, some of them went downriver and then up in Arctic Village area. And that's one of those, it just like it splintered off the group. Yeah.
Do they still keep in contact with?
We do. In fact, in Arctic Village, we do have Han originally from here. Their mother was born and raised here, and she went down and married somebody there. So those children, they're all, once in a while, they all come back here, just check it out, yeah. But we pretty well keep in contact with a lot of people. Same way with Dawson. We keep in a lot of contact with them. We support Dawson in doing a lot of things, and then they in turn support us doing a lot of, if I have a potlatch, Dawson would come down if we requested them, and they would dance and sing and all that. So we feel pretty good about that. Yeah, we exchange, we help them up there and a lot of other things. Yeah.
So the international border didn't cut the contact?
No.
Good. Yeah. So, do they still have those moose hide gatherings?
They just had one this summer.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't go, though. I don't think any of us went, but they did have a big one this summer. So 2 years from now. But I think what's happening is they've been talks that they may not have it anymore because it costs too much, too expensive.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah. For one people, one tribe to do it, you know, you have to, if you get donations and just offset some of the costs, that will do, but they afford all the bill, and I guess it gets pretty much, you know, yeah. Well, they feed everybody for 3 or 4 days.
Yeah. So is it only, are the moose hide gatherings for Han people, or are they more?
No, it started that everybody would come there. And as one way of the Hans from down here going up and sharing with them. But every tribe and all over comes. Everybody like that because it's a big gathering. So everybody, a lot of Wichins there, a lot of Canadian, other tribes in Canada come, clans. Not for only Hans.
Yeah,
just everybody. And they do a lot of languages, and they do a lot of dancing, and they do a lot of they're trying to reclaim some of the things that they have lost. And that's what most of those gatherings are for, you know, just to try to reclaim some of the lost culture and customs that they did years ago. Because the customs that we have and the traditional values that we place, we're beginning to lose it all. So one of the things is that we can regain some of that through contact with different tribes and the people over there, you know.
So have you then like revived some of the old customs?
First time in my life I ever start drumming, and I drum with Dawson singing group. There's about three or four drummers, and I was one of them. And it sort of, you see, Dawson lost everything, lost all their song and dance and the potlatch. So they want to revise that back into as their traditional stuff. But it takes a hard time doing it. You have to have a leader who's going to dedicate, and some of the elders to come and show you. And they were very fortunate that Laura Sanford in Tok showed them a lot of things there, and that's the way they got it back. And then now they have a pretty good drumming and song and dance, and everybody sing. So I know that it's all well and good, but we don't practice. And they have a band, they have a singing group that they practice, and they just do everything. But, you know, we don't have one down here, so I do have a drum, and I drum with them every now and then.
So Eagle Village is not very, they don't do those things so much?
We have a potlatch similar to long time ago. But it's also that we don't have singing and dancing because we got nobody that does that. And during those times, sometimes we invite them, but it's during the winter, and sometimes it's hard to get here. But in the summertime, some of our stuff that we have had here, they come and they really support us. They sit down, everybody. And with that big tourist boat coming, the Yukon Queen, they could get down there, and we just tell them that they reserve so many seats for us, and then the Eagle Village, through Holland America, they give us, and you know, they just, in kind service, they just let us have 20 seats or whatever it is. They just give it to us, you know, so we can have a lot of them come down, round trip. That's the way I used to do it. I don't know how they do it now. I talked to Yukon Queen, and they said, could you do as a courtesy to the tribe, we're going to the thing, and could you let us have about 10, 15, whatever seats available so that we can go up there? And they said, no problem, and they donate that to us.
Yeah. Nice.
And I got Dawson people down here one time, 20, I think it was 22 people down here, and we didn't have to pay for it. They do it as a in-kind service.
So why was so much of the culture lost?
Huh?
Why was so much of the culture lost?
What do you mean?
I mean like those songs and dances and stuff like that. Why were they forgotten?
You see, people lose interest, and people think that it's not, people don't think it's important. But any native people, elders would tell you that you got to have your culture, your heritage, and your language to survive. And it's part of those three that you need. So you have to get those to do that. But one of the things is that in the United States, when we went to school, they didn't let us speak our native tongue. So we had to speak English, and if we didn't speak English, they punish us for that. They punish us for speaking our language. So that's why we lost it. They call it an assimilation into the dominant society in the westernization of the Indian people. And that's all it was. We had to go to their school. We had to do everything that they did. We had to do just like them or else. So that's the way we lost all our culture. Over there, the government didn't let them do any of these things. They threw them in jail if they catch them. The government took their drums away for singing with a drum. And I show you a good picture. I don't think I have it here, but there's a picture of Dawson people dancing, the Han dancing, and the person was beating a wash tub, a tub. And I said, why do he beat that? He said, they didn't have a drum. The government took it away. And the story goes that at that time, the Chief Isaac over there in Dawson came over to Tanacross, Tok area, and said, they're taking all our drums and our songs away from us up there in the government. So he brought some songs and he brought some drums over here for safekeeping so the government over there don't take it away from them. And years after that, when it was okay by the government to sing and dance, then they came back over and they sort of took that home. So both governments were against the culture that you were born into, you know. But that's one of the reasons why we lost a lot of our traditional ways and even our values, you know.
Do you think it's changing? But are the values like regained?
Well, it's changing to a certain extent. But like anything, you have to practice and then you get better. But we're not doing it, you know. Like me, I'm a linguist and I could speak and understand my language. But even me, I have to speak it every day or else I begin to lose little by little. So what I'm saying, yes and no, but what do we do? It's not in any of the schools. It's supposed to be taught at home by the parent. And if it's not, then it's no good. You got to get the kids, the children, you got to get them at an early age, and they could catch on fast. But if you try later years, you know. Some people wouldn't spend the time to relearn those things. And we are very lucky that we do have a few people here that understands and could speak it very fluently. But we also know that there's a lot of things that we don't practice and we completely lost it.
So was it your home language? Like, did your parents speak Han to you?
My mom and dad spoke Han to us as our first language. In fact, when I was 9 years old, I went to my first grade school, and that's all I knew Han. I didn't know English. I was pretty well broken up English. But we stayed out of Eagle. So I think the Davids, the Pauls, and the Junibees, that's how come those three families sort of retained the language. We were away from here, not only 1 year, but maybe 5 or 6 years. At one time, we were down there in the woods. We lived there year round. So I think that was the good thing that happened to us. That's how come we retained it. We were not in the village. And then we came back in 1952, and it's altogether English only and all that, you know? Yeah. And I sometimes realize that that was the best thing that ever happened to us, to be out there isolated from Eagle, and that's why we still carry that, we still could speak and understand.
Were there lots of kids in those three families?
I think there was about 8-9 of us, and about 5 or 6 in the Paul, and about 5 in the David. So we probably had about 15 kids at the most.
Wow.
So, I mean, Dr. Patty's wife sort of set up some kind of a school for us, but that's, you know, that's a long time ago. That Dr. Patty was the president of the University of Alaska. Yeah, Dr. Ernest N. Patty.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was the president up there.
Yeah, they're still the mining engineers.
Yeah, he's a mining engineer, yeah.
So, I had something in mind, and I was lost. Oh, yeah, what did your dads do, and mothers? Like, what did they work?
My dad was a drive a cab, and he worked down there during the summertime. And that's all he did all his life. He just drive, he's a, what they call an operator. Big heavy equipment, that's all he did. And the other people was one of the Pauls. The man's name was Susie, and he was a heavy equipment man. And then the other one worked on the dredge. But throughout the years, there was a lot of people from here worked down there. But those were the three people that the mine opened up in 1936, and they've been down there from 37 through about 1962 when they closed down the camp. So those three people, my dad, Willie Jernby, Harry David, and Susie Paul were the long, out of everybody, they were like the long tenured ones. Yeah, they stayed there. They worked there a long time, the longest.
What did they do in winter?
We stayed, a lot of times we stayed down there, and my dad would trap, and then he would cut wood for the camp. This is the coming summer, like next summer, they cut wood for that, and then the dredge, they used a lot of wood to run the furnace on the dredge too, you know. So they cut wood, and then they also trap. So that's the way they get by, but it was very, very, I mean, I tell people that, and people said, well, how'd you guys do? You know, that's a rough life. But we were pretty, if you really want to know, probably we were pretty tough, you know. It'd have to be if you were out there with a bunch of kids.
Yeah. So your mother just took care of the home,
yeah,
kids.
Yeah, she would stay home, yeah.
So what did your kids do?
We all did our own little shares, you know, chores, yeah.
Ah.
I do a lot of cutting wood too, you know, a lot of cut wood and everything. And it was cold. Winter times are cold up there, so you know, yeah. So we grew up down there half of our life. The first maybe 5 or 6 years were spent right down there. Yeah, not coming back to Eagle or anything. So, you know, we got to do lots without, yeah. Summertime, you get all those workers there, and it's pretty good. There's a lot of people there. Crews, work crews, you know, yeah.
Do you remember any of the old-timers?
Well, I know a lot of old-timers. They're all pretty well gone there, yeah. Some of the old-timers that I remember worked down there was right up from here. It was George Beck was working down there. Elisha Lyman worked down there. They're all gone now. Phil Braille, one of the guys from down there, worked there. I think even George McGregor, those old timers that eventually moved to Eagle later years, My dad, the Genrich, Harry Genrich was the boss, the supervisor of the camp. And actually, he had two other brothers that worked right there with him. There was his brother Lester and Don, but I think there's another one too. And then the cooks were, I remember all of them. The cook was Flo Genrich. And then the mining, the guy who actually was a timekeeper was Kit Murray and Sally Murray. And I remember them because we see them all the time, you know. And then Dr. Patty, Ernest N. Patty was there. And his son were just young at that time. He had three sons. There were Dale, Ernest, and Stanton. But in later years, Dale Patty took over for his dad as the boss there of the whole mining operation. And I worked for Dale in Woodchopper one year in 1961, 62. And then Dr. Patty, I worked for, I think it was in Coal Creek one year. Dr. Patty was trying to tell me to go to college and he paid for it. And I said, no, I don't want to go to college.
Really?
I said, I'm gonna go to join the army.
Ah, yeah. So, were you also heavy?
Huh?
Were you also heavy equipment operator?
No, I was an oiler on dredge. I made sure that the dredge, all the parts on the dredge that were working were oiled and greased. And that's what I did.
Where were we? You oiled the dredge.
Yeah, I was what they call the oiler. I did all the oiling. I did all the greasing of parts on the dredge. And you have to have it because the dredge operates 24 hours a day. And you can't break down, you know. Because one of the things I remember is that once the dredge stops, you lose a lot of time. When it operates, it's getting all the gold, so you make time. But when you shut down and repair and break down, it's no good because you lose all that your time, you know. In other words, you could be broke down for 3 hours. Well, you get 3 hours behind. So you got to make it all up, but sometimes it's hard to do. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess good oiling is really important for the function.
Yeah, well, I think it was, yeah. And my dad would drive a cat. What they would do is that before the dredge goes over any ground, my dad would doze it off. Like with the cat, he'd just push it away and then the dredge goes right down through there. And sometime you have to let it go from one year to another. Because it's all frozen, permafrost. So he dozed this whole thing right there and let it go this summer. Next year they'll go there and they'll dredge that. But the other year at time they'll be over here someplace. So they just keep coming back. And that permafrost is pretty deep sometimes. 3, 4, maybe even 5, 6 feet. So it's pretty, you can't dig it. You know, you have to let it thaw out. So from one year to the next year, they sometime after they doze it off with a blade, you know, like on the cap,
yeah.
They let it go, let it thaw out.
And it did?
Yeah.
Wow.
It thawed enough where you can dredge it, you know, with a big dredge. You ever see a dredge down there?
Yeah, I haven't. I wish I had.
I think they got pictures down there at national parks, you know.
I see pictures of it, but it's really hard to imagine how the machine would look like. It must have been big and
it's big.
Scary.
I was scared the first time I went to work in there.
Is it like big like a house would be?
It's bigger than a house. Yeah. And probably about, it's probably just as big as a hotel.
Yeah.
Maybe about 4 story. Yeah. No, maybe about two stories, three stories around in there. But it's big and long, you know. One side the buckets go back and forth, and the other side it's digging on one side, and then on the rear end of it, that's where all the rocks and all the stuff go through, go back in, go back out.
Yeah, tailings.
Yeah,
what the are tailings, they called?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it floated in a big pond.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the one. Yeah. You see it someplace, huh?
Yeah, I've seen pictures of it.
Mm-hmm.
So you worked there for a couple of years.
I worked there during the summertime. You can't work wintertime because everything frees up. So
okay.
I worked there in 1961, 62, and a little bit in 1975, I think. 1973 and 74.
Was it 70s when Joe Vogler had a...
I worked for, wasn't Joe Vogler.
No?
Joe Vogler had his claims right next to Chopper Creek, just up above it. But in 1973, Ernie Wolf and Dan Coben operate the dredge in Coal Creek, down by the river, toward the river, yeah.
Huh.
Joe Vogler just had claims up there off Iron Creek and Mineral Creek.
Oh.
And Mineral Creek goes into Woodchopper Creek, and that's where the dredge is, right on Mineral Creek. It's right off of those creeks. That's where it gets water to make the ponds, yeah. But Joe Vogler got his own claims over there. It's a private claim.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Personal property, private property, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But he's over there, yeah.
Yeah, the 70s. And so there was nobody at Coal Creek.
Well, what happened, at one time they used to run two camps at the same time. And then toward last, you know, they run one camp, and then next year they go over to Woodchopper Creek, the following year they go back to Coal Creek. They alternate. But
yeah.
At one time way back there they ran two camps and two crews. Yeah. It's all a separate, different operation. You know, it's the same company but it's just different creeks, different dredge. Yeah.
Yeah. So the both dredges still exist there. Are the both dredges still there?
Yeah, it's still there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the one in Coal Creek. It probably could operate yet too.
Hmm.
Yes. That came into the country in 1936, I think. It's it's almost 80 years old, and it could operate.
Maybe if the price of gold comes up, somebody
will
take it.
The National Parks won't let you.
Oh, that's right. It's park
in
area
the,
now.
It's in the parks, yeah.
Yeah.
And they're against mining, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Can't have that.
Yeah.
So how about, is there any mining in the Eagle area nowadays?
I guess there was a lot of mining outside of Eagle, very close by. But that's way back before I was born, before I got to be of age. But there's one mine that's kind of operating out on the highway about 10 miles out. That's the only thing. But back in the old, early days, back way back, there used to be mines over there in 70 Mile and down on Nation River and 70 Mile and all these creeks that are nearby. And there was even a mine out there where they call 4th of July, down river. 4th of July is another creek down there. It's a tributary, goes into the Yukon. I think it goes into the 70, it goes into the Charlie River, and then it goes into the Yukon. But there's no more mines down that way. Usually all your mines happen about the same time as the gold rush in Canada. And once they have their stampede over there, you know, you can only have so many mines. Because people, there was people everywhere over there. So every creek that was on the river, they all migrated down toward there. 40 Mile River, Chicken, Boundary, all those creeks back here, they all have miners on there. And Franklin, and this is the after effects of the gold rush up there in Klondike. And it went even all the way down to Circle. Around Circle, those are the, a lot of miners come down there because it got too crowded up there, too many people. So a lot of them came down, and every creek that came into the Yukon had been mined. Yeah,
and there was those weird little towns like Star City and
Nation. Yeah, that's down that way too. That's in 70 Mile, I think. Yeah, and Star City had a post office. So it was a pretty incorporated city. Because at that time, during those days, if there was a post office there, it's got to be a pretty good size, you know, yeah. So I know which one you're talking about.
Was there anything, any buildings or?
There's a lot of them still half standing.
Oh.
There's some on the 40 Mile River, and then some of those that were standing was down there at Coal Creek. That's all refurbished, restored, you know? The old, there was a roadhouse down there on the riverbank, and the National Parks restored it back to its original.
Slavens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they could do a lot of things because they got a lot of big money too, you know, so they could do it, whereas I can do it. But they can get most anything as close to what the original state was. Yeah. And there's a lot of other places where it's all torn, it's all fallen down. But they protect a lot of those areas because it's old, you know, it's part of that history of that day. Yeah.
So how do you think, what's your opinion on how the mining activities have affected life in Eagle?
Well, it's just like any place else. It brought in a lot of people, and it brought in some money for the people, you know, and there were a lot of people made it for that time, for during that time, but you know, I think that if you look at Eagle was at one time like a mining town, and that's what made Eagle part of Eagle history, is that it was done by mining too, you know. And then you got all these steamboats at that time. The steamboats were put in effect by about 19 in the 30s. I think they were pretty good. I think they had about 16 different boats on the river at one time, on steamboats they call them, and they were all passengers too, you know, passenger boats. But you look at Fairbanks, mining started Fairbanks. That's the birth of Fairbanks. And I would say that even though we were the first incorporated city, miners came into Eagle to find gold. And that's where the people came from at one time. Yeah. Well, but the Han Indians, they were here, you know, that's way back there, yeah.
Yeah, do you know about the old Han settlement? And was it always on the riverbank
down
there?
Down river, and down by the National Park Service is supposed to be an old Han burial ground.
Oh.
Yeah, right down here. And then right down below the graveyard, the one that flooded, there was supposed to be a Johnny's village there. That's where it was. But later years, I think it moved down a little bit. You know, Johnny's village, that's another village from up here. But the Hans were very, at that time, the Hans were very, very, they, Because they were the last tribe to make contact with the outside world. Mm-hmm. You know, we held back quite a bit. Some tribe, they just hit the settlers, the trappers, and the Hudson Bay people, the people that discover. And some of them, they start trading right out, but the Han people were one of the last people to make contact with the outside world. So we had our own form of government, and it was running pretty good. They were doing a lot of things that were already organized way even before the town was organized. So, you know, they had good leadership. Yeah.
How was the old leadership?
Huh?
What was the old leadership like?
Well, there was a chief and his council. And talk about Chief Charlie around that nation. I guess from what he was a pretty I think one of the things you had to have a lot of that is that you got to have be pretty smart within your own way. And at that time they picked chiefs by who you are, which I don't think it's going by which family, but that you knew about your culture and your way of life. And that's the way they picked chiefs at that time. And somebody that is very well respected, because they have to they talk with other people to have meetings, you know. But I think at that time, you know, they're still pretty wise people. They're wise people, a lot of those chiefs. That's how come they've never been put down. They've never been in wars. They never did. They had wars here, but that's way back. But I don't know about that, but that's how come they never fell. They were smart. Well, the one we talk about mostly that I hear is Chief Charlie. And then there's Dawson, they had that Chief Isaac, who was very, very, they're shrewd people within their own ways. Yeah, they knew a lot of things. The government didn't mind them when they talked to them, and they, you know, in a lot of places like that, they didn't want the Indian, the chiefs didn't want their people to get mixed up with the other people. No, he said, I don't want you to mix up with my people.
Isn't that how Moosehide was started?
Huh?
Isn't that how Moosehide Village was started?
Yeah. Well, Moosehide Village is... It was a Han village, but there was Gwich'ins there and other tribes there too, you know. But Moosehide is a federal reserve. It's like a reservation. It's way back when. And one of the ministers helped them put that. They requested, they wanted a reservation. And that's the way they got that Moosehide. But Moosehide has a story in itself that because there was no more teachers and no more places to teach them, they all had to go back to Dawson to live there, and that's where they got their schooling. But at one time they had teachers and everything right there. A lot of missionary people did a lot of that, you know. But Moosehide, I think it goes a long ways back. It's actually a Indian reserve that's set aside. It's got its own boundary. Yeah, I don't know who got that with for them. You know, I think it was a guy by the name of Toffee. I don't know. I read it, but I know. But we were very weak. I believe we just didn't want to be bothered. You know, yeah. But I think once contact was made, then that's when we start integrating. Yeah. But I don't think that we didn't want. I don't think that we, the Han people, had ever made any trouble or any with the white people that came into the country. I think that once contact was made, we all got alone, because we had to, they depended upon us and then we depended upon them, you know? We teach each other, yeah? But that's way before my time, that's way long time ago. Mm.
Yeah, that's in 1800s. Yeah, it's a long time ago.
Yeah.
I read this book from one creator, like memoirs, and it was pretty evident.
Who was it?
Maybe it was. Oh, was it Murray? Maybe.
Murray.
Yeah, and he wrote that kind of. And I got the sense that they were really dependent on, you know, Han people and other native groups to bring them food.
You see, what happens too is that because we were here and we adapt to our environment, and then these people, they come from, at that time they call it the New World. They try to discover something and they look for something. Well, sometimes they're not prepared. So it's the Indians who actually help them, save them in a lot of, even sometimes they say the Indians would help them through their first winters and stuff like that, you know, because they were already here when all this happened, so they knew about it, you know. It may be pretty old ways, but they got along. I mean, they survived, so they helped a lot of these newcomers. And then that's the way they got along together pretty good. You know? They learned from each other. Some of them, and then they, during the trading days, you know, when everybody started trading, that was one of the things. But when they start trading, you have to realize that a lot of things were cheap. Some of those made up for some of the stuff that we had. All of a sudden you start getting fabric from different countries from the New World. That one would be cheaper than moose skin or something like that. So that's the way those things came in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Because people look for cheaper stuff, but it's something that will serve whatever purpose, you know, clothing. And that's one of the things I looked at one time, is that the skins and all the stuff that we were wearing, it was much, well, you have to work to get it, you know, you have to tan it and smoke it and all that. Well, here comes all these other new materials from the New World over in foreign country. And that's what was one of the big change. Before too long, you know, we were wearing Western New World shirt and pants and stuff like that, you know?
I'm sure it's so much easier.
That's what it is.
You just go to traders and buy your clothes.
What they call it, accommodable. Mm. Yeah. It was there, you know, so, you know, that's what happens, yeah. Changes.
Just out of curiosity, do you know how long it would take to tan a moose hide?
I don't know.
A long time, I'm sure.
Yeah, my mom did that a couple of times, but it takes quite a while. You do it the right way, you know.
Mm.
Yeah, but it's a lot of work. Yeah. But they used to do that. I don't even think now we got anybody in the village can't do that. They don't know how. They probably see it done, but it's nobody does it. They buy it from the store.
Yeah. How about, does anybody do any other kind of, like, these traditional crafts, like baskets or?
There's a few basket makers here, and there's a lot of beaders, you know, beads, but sewing. But I think we don't have any snowshoe making or sled making. And these are all the old arts and crafts that they did. Snowshoe, they used to make their own snowshoes. They used to make sleds for the dog team, toboggan for the dog team. Now people don't know. You know, just let it go. You see, changes is one of the things that we have to learn. Because as we grow with the people, we also have to grow with the things that were changing our lives. You know? And no more dog team. You know, where you got snow machines or something else. I think even the four-wheelers count now. Yeah. But I think that we have seen the changes. But I think that we adapt, the Han Indians adapt to the changes very good. You know, and I think in a lot of instances, they liked it. You know, hey, we don't have to do some other thing sometime because we already got something that's similar to that. That's the way I describe that, you know. And sometimes, it may not work. Some of that stuff may not work, but at least it's cheaper, you know.
So, does anybody use snowshoes anymore? Mm-hmm. No, not at all.
Nobody.
Yeah.
It's pretty sad. We lost arts and craft. My dad was the snowshoe when he made a few. But there was an old timer here, Joe Malcolm, and Joe Malcolm was the last of our snowshoe maker here. And he died back in the 60s or latter part of 60s. Yeah. But we lost a lot of our craft, you know, arts and craft. We have a few birch bark basket makers. There's some people could still do it. But in order to actually live a good subsistence lifestyle, you have to be able to perform a lot of this stuff because you have to be self-sufficient, and that's all it is. You have to be able to, I see when they talk about different things on subsistence. You know, subsistence means that the ability for you to survive in this climate and the harsh climate with what you got. And that's the way you got to do to survive. What happens if you didn't do it? You probably die. You see what I mean? That's the difference. And today, I don't have to hunt if I don't want to survive. I can buy meat anywhere. You see what I mean, the difference? But at that time, people have to go out and hunt and bring in the food. If they don't, the family will not make it, and it's going to be a hard time for them. And people don't understand that that's a hard, hard life. But hey, they did it, and that's the only way they can call themselves, like even long, long ways, they call themselves subsistence users. I think too is that if I go back and say I am a subsistent man, I would be very, very, I would be lying, I believe, because I utilize a lot of other things. Because to be a subsistent on the land, you have to be able to utilize around you what is there available for you to get by, and the ability to hunt and fish and trap, and then that will help your family. But me, I could, anything I want, I could buy at the store. So I mean, I don't go without, I could buy, and you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't have that chance during those days, and there was some poor times, and there was some good times. So that's the difference.
Yeah, I guess back in those days you just had to do it, or
yeah, that's right.
If you didn't,
or else you
don't
make it.
That's about it. So when did it start changing in Eagle Village?
Like, well,
when did people stop trapping?
In any time that you see changes is when something happens to a community, and that could be by bringing people coming in. I think the changes you see is the steamboat bring people in. The army was here for about 10 or 12 years, and then they built that telegraph to Valdez, the telegraph wire. They sent from Eagle to Valdez. Those were the changes. And then the highway coming in back in 1950 was a big change, because not only were you just a little settlement, but now people start coming in. And I believe, but there was different regulations, different law that changed a lot of people. A lot of changes were right on the land that we lived on. They were taking it and changing regulations on that. The government will just take anything and they'll claim it. And that's what happened. No longer do you have to do a lot of things that you have done, but you got to do a permit and a hunting license to do these things. And we never had to do it at one time, because we have a right at one time. Anybody in rural areas right now can do these things. But at one time, because of the responsibility that the government had to the people, we could hunt and fish and trap and anything. You know, we didn't have to have license. But now you got hunting license and caribou tags and harvest tickets and everything like that. So. But in all too, with all these regulations coming down, Native Land Claim Act, other acts that came through changed a lot of people. The National Parks Act, the one Integrities Act that came in to form these parks and preserve, that changed a lot of things, you know. Not only are you under government when you're on the land, but, you know, government is a regulation. So that's why it changed. Yeah.
So was it that people just figured that it's easier to buy there?
Yeah. We do both. Mm. There's still a lot of people go out there and do some hunting. And within the law, the government is supposed to protect our hunting and fishing and trapping rights under subsistence. But I don't even know if it's happening, because they're making a lot of regulations, and the regulations are like they're arresting people. They shouldn't have to be doing that, because the right is that we have that. The hunting and trapping and the fishing that the government is supposed to protect for a lot of the rural people is that it's supposed to go on whether it's a park or not a park. But it's supposed to go on like you originally did it. You didn't have to have a permit. You didn't have to have this and that. You just go have it and then get your whatever. But now regulations are changing every day. And that's what is a big change right now, is that it's changing people's lives. People move here to get out of that kind of a thing out in the States, and all of a sudden they have to abide, and they don't like it.